There are these two guys on the screen. One guy says to the other, "You know, life is like a fountain." And the other guy says, "Oh, really? How so?" And the first guy says, "All right, so it's not like a fountain."
Please, I need help. I've already talked to the other rabbis. Please. It's not about Danny's bar mitzvah. My boy Danny, this coming Shabbos, very joyous event. That's all fine. It's more about myself. I've had quite a bit of tsuris lately. Marital problems, professional, you name it. This is not a frivolous request. This is I've tried to be a serious man, you know? Tried to do right, be a member of the community, raise the... Danny, Sarah, they both go to school, Hebrew school, a good breakfast. Well, Danny goes to Hebrew school. Sarah doesn't have time. She mostly washes her hair. Apparently, there are several steps involved, but you don't have to tell Marshak that. Just tell him I need help. Please, I need help.
The rabbi is busy.
He didn't look busy.
He's thinking.
Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
Hi, Rob.
Hello, J. Robert.
It's been a long time.
It has.
I had a friend who used to call me sometimes when we hadn't talked in a while, and he'd sing that part from the Led Zeppelin song. It's been a long time, been a long time, been a long, 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 long time. So,
are you about to do that?
Not really. I don't sing Robert Plant very well.
All right. It has been a long time though, and it's not what I expected actually, because we used to podcast long distance from San Francisco to Chicago, and when we were finally in the same town, you'd think it would be you'd think it'd be a lot easier, but schedules don't get any easier regardless of where you live. So
no, and it's just odd that when you can podcast face to face, that's sort of what you want to do, or at least what I want to do, but then that adds another layer of difficulty.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not just that we can pick up the phone and call, we have to, you know, find a good way to be somewhere where we can record.
Yeah, exactly.
So why don't we start off with the Coen brothers? I know there's a lot of people talking about A Serious Man and thinking about it, and I know you like that film, and
yeah.
And so I'm you know, I don't like it quite as much, and so I'm curious why you do like it.
All right. Well, let's run down where we stand with the Coens at this point, because let's catch everybody up. I can give my rundown. You know, loved the Coens when I was in college. Mm. Loved Blood Simple and Raising Arizona and up through Fargo, and then at a certain point, maybe after The Big Lebowski, maybe from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou on, it's sort of like, well, I think I've seen all of their tricks now. Mm. And I don't know that they, as talented as they clearly are, I'm not sure they have anything to say to me or anything to explain about the world I live in. Or maybe I'm changing. Maybe they're, I don't know, maybe they've fallen into a rut. I don't know what it is, but I became less interested in their movies over time. And I've talked to other people who sort of feel the same way. Mm. And even when No Country for Old Men came around and clearly had this sort of serious tone, I didn't buy it, at least at first. And we won't rehash all of that. There's a podcast out there with you and I talking about what we think of No Country for Old Men. I didn't like it as well as most people, even though it's obviously a very interesting movie. And then Burn After Reading their follow-up, I didn't like it all. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of, I sort of was back to the old, well, you know, Coen Brothers. I'm not even sure they're on my must-see list. Mm-hmm. but I always sort of in the back of my mind harbor this hope that they will do something that really affects me. And I think they actually finally have. A Serious Man, I think, is a really great movie. I like it a lot. And it may be hard to say exactly why, but I think for the first time I really buy that they are exploring some serious ideas. It's a funny movie. I think for the most part, I hear of people coming out of it thinking that it's very bleak, which maybe it is, but also it's a comedy, clearly, through most of it.
What do you think is funny?
Well, I think there's sort of, let's say a little bit about what it's about. Okay. There's a guy who, he's a physics professor.
Yep.
And he suddenly is having lots of problems in his life. Yes. His wife is leaving him is the big thing.
Not just leaving him, but leaving him for like his nemesis.
Cy Abelman.
Yes.
With Esther barely in the grave.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
There are lots of things that are funny about it in the Coen Brothers style, which is these repeated phrases. Mm-hmm. Esther barely in the grave. It's repeated a couple of times of Cy Abelman, as if this is means something to us, you know.
Yeah.
And then when we do see Cy Abelman, you know, he's a very calm and supportive person, not the sort of he doesn't respond the way you'd want someone to respond, which is, you don't want the person who your wife is leaving you for to come and give you a hug and talk about it and
bring a bottle of wine.
Exactly. So there are things like that that are very funny. And then there's also, as he's trying to understand what's going on with his life, as his life is falling apart, and it isn't just this one thing. This
is the professor, not Cy.
The professor, yeah. This is the major thing, but there are other things in his life too. Mm-hmm. His brother is living with them and is having problems of his own, and so he's having sort of to deal with that. He has problems at school. There's a student who is pressuring him to improve his grade.
Yes.
Illegitimately. So anyway, he's trying to make sense of all these things that are sort of raining down on him, and several people encourage him to talk to a rabbi, and so he makes appointments to see the rabbi.
Yes, because we should point out that the professor, Larry, is sort of quintessentially Jewish, but in a suburban way. You know, it's not a Woody Allen New York Jew. It's the Jewish and who's left for the suburbs maybe two generations ago.
Yeah, and this takes place several decades ago. So yeah. It's a sort of a period of time, a small American town with a large Jewish community. And lots of people in that community encourage him to talk to the rabbi. And he's from a family that goes to temple, but it doesn't seem like it's a major part of his life. But he feels he's going to turn to that at this point and try to make some sense of this. And so there are these sort of parodies of the levels of structure around Judaism.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that made me think of Franz Kafka's novel, The Trial. Mm. And for some reason, I thought of it fairly early on. And once I did, I sort of was seeing it, seeing the movie, A Serious Man, through that lens. And I love that novel. And so I really enjoyed seeing the parallels, almost to the point that it's an adaptation of the book. And I don't actually know if the Coens had this in mind. This is purely my interpretation. But it gave me so much to think about throughout that it's my favorite way to look at it.
Mm.
And in a similar way, Kafka is funny and yet bleak at the same time. You could see it either way. And mm-hmm. so I like that about A Serious Man.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the parallels then for The Trial, and maybe, for people who don't know the book or at least haven't read it in a long time.
Well, the book is about a guy named Joseph K., who one day is accused of a crime, it seems, and he needs to defend himself. He needs to hire an advocate. He needs to meet with that person and go over his case. But he can never find out anything more than this. You know, there are people there serving him papers at the beginning. And so it's this sort of confusing bureaucracy that he needs to somehow navigate and never really gets to the bottom of this. He's just sort of accused of something, and it seems like it's going to become a part of his life. Mm. It is just who he is now. He's going to have to forever defend himself. And there are just all these layers and layers of bureaucracy in that novel. And because of that, that's sort of how I think that novel is seen, as a comment on bureaucracy.
Mm.
And the term Kafkaesque, I think, more often than not refers to The Trial more than anything else that Kafka wrote, as this sort of, heavy burden that society puts on individuals. but I think there's another way to read the book. I think that's a perfectly legitimate way to read the book. But I think another way is that maybe Joseph K. really is guilty. And maybe guilt is just sort of manifest in society very slowly, but eventually. Because he is presented as not necessarily a squeaky clean guy. You know, we want to think that he's just completely innocent and this is a crazy thing that's happening to him. Could happen to anybody. But maybe he is guilty. And I think regardless of whether he is, and you never really know because you never really know anything about the case, it is a novel about guilt and innocence, regardless of what the answer to that is. And I think that's also true of A Serious Man.
So do you see Larry then as these problems are somehow a manifestation of guilt?
Well, I think he sees it that way.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what's really interesting, because no one has accused him of anything in the in the movie. And yet he's always saying things like, I haven't done anything. I haven't done anything. Or there's a point that I find really, really touching, is when He's at the third, he's trying to get in to see the third rabbi, unsuccessfully having seen the lower level rabbis. And he's saying, he's pleading his case, and he's saying, I've tried to be a serious man. You know, he stops himself there. He can't quite make himself say, I'm a serious man, but he wants to be. Mm-hmm. And I think he recognizes that he has things about him that aren't serious, as we all do. He's not a bad person, but we all sort of live in a state of guilt. And I think that's true of Kafka's novel also, that even if Joseph K. isn't really guilty, the fact is he may have to live with this for the rest of his life. And so there's no difference between having guilt and having to defend yourself from guilt all the time.
It's interesting. The first time we hear the phrase a serious man in the movie, if I remember right, is actually, is at a funeral. And a funeral of, I won't give this away because it's actually sort of an important plot point, but it's a funeral of someone that we've come not to respect. And so therefore, when the rabbi says that so-and-so was a serious man, it feels false. And so for me, that phrase then becomes colored in the rest of the film as the sort of thing people say that they can't quite mean. Would that fit with your reading then?
I think it could. I think the difference between a serious man, there's a difference between a serious man and an able man. Cy Abelman, for example. You know, it's one thing to be serious and respected and profound, another to simply be competent. You know, it's like a lesser kind of compliment. And this sort of ties in with Larry is on the verge of getting tenure.
Yeah.
And so that's another way that he's being measured by the community.
And his son is about to have his bar mitzvah, which is another way of being measured.
That's right. Everybody's reaching this sort of rite of passage, and Larry sees them both as sort of reflections of himself. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the guys from the tenure committee is always coming into his office and saying, you know, this isn't something you need to worry about. We're not considering these things that people are writing to us about. Yeah. I just want you to know, we're not considering those. Wait a minute, what? They're saying what?
It reminds me of, there's this great line when Larry goes to the second rabbi, and the second rabbi is sort of trying to explain things, and the rabbi goes, "We can't know everything." And Larry says, "Seems like you don't know anything." And it's this is sort of why I wanted to ask what you found funny, because my problems with the film stem in some ways from my problems with the Coen brothers in general, which is their kind of humor and what they find funny. Because it strikes me throughout the movie, more so as it goes on, maybe not quite as much at the beginning, that it's just that sort of snarky kind of humor that is often leveled at the Coen brothers, and which I think is often, unfortunately, true. And so, yes, there's parts of it that are funny, but it's not a serious kind of humor, shall we say. It's an easy kind of humor. I had this feeling fairly early on in the movie that one of the reasons why Larry is a suburban Jew is because that's the one accent in American culture that the Coen brothers haven't made fun of yet. It's like, well, let's see, who else can we sort of caricature? Oh yeah, suburban Jews, we haven't done them. And I realize that's not exactly a very fair statement, because the movie is about being Jewish, at least in certain ways, and they do take that seriously. But the humor rubs me wrong and makes me distrust their clearly attempts to be more serious. And so let me go back to the question, what do you find funny?
Well, I find that line funny. Mm-hmm. It's at the end of a big Shaggy Dog story where we think maybe we're going to get to something of import.
Yeah.
You know, there must be some reason this serious rabbi is telling him this story. There's going to be, and in fact, it's about a message that's etched into someone's teeth mysteriously.
Yeah.
But what does it mean? What is the message? What does it mean? Well, you can't know everything.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know anything. But on top of that, it's like, well, the message says something like, be good to people, or help people. And so maybe the message is, help people, couldn't hurt. The rabbi's final conclusion is, help people, couldn't hurt. You know, that seems like a pretty good message. What is there to complain about? You know, well, it just doesn't seem profound enough. That's able, that's not serious. Yeah. You know, that's competent, that's not serious. Maybe life isn't so profound. Maybe the lessons to be learned here are much simpler than you'd expect. Embrace the mystery is something that comes up a couple of times, too.
You think the Coen brothers believe that?
That life is simpler than all the structure makes it out to be? Sure.
Well, that's a nice way of saying it. You know, for me, it's like what I always take away, not always, but a lot of times I take away from the Coen brothers, and why I like No Country for Old Men so much more than so much of their other work was because they didn't seem to be doing this, is that, you know, at the end of the day, who the bleep knows? And so, well, what are you going to do? You know, that's often what I take away from a Coen brothers film, this sort of feeling, well, what are you going to do? But the way they portray that is with kind of a condescension that I find it sort of irritates me, it chafes in ways that I find frustrating. And that was certainly true of A Serious Man as well.
Well, I think a lot of people boil that message down to life is meaningless.
Yeah.
And that's what the Coens are saying. But I'm not sure that's true.
No.
And I think there is a moment where there's a moment that works against that, I think. And it's when Larry's brother, who is just an odd person who spends all of his time on the Mentaculous, this model for the world.
Oh, he spends all his time in the bathroom.
Well, working on the Mentaculous.
Yes.
He's got this notebook full of all this gibberish, basically, but it's somehow his model for the world. Mm-hmm. And things don't go well for him either. And there's a point in the middle of the night when they're both up, and Larry goes outside to console his brother, who's out there sobbing. And he's saying, you know, God hasn't given me shit. It's actually a very serious moment. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is that isn't the end of the scene, or that isn't the whole story of this scene, because it's something that he's saying to Larry, who is having a lot of the same feelings, but doesn't voice them in the middle of the night to, mm-hmm. you know, out to the heavens. But his brother does. His brother's saying, you know, God hasn't given me shit. Hey, mm-hmm. look what he's given you. He's given me nothing. Which, there's this pause in the dialogue, and the question that I think I was thinking and that Larry was thinking and that Larry eventually voices is, well, what has he given me? Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you make this point. And I don't want to change the subject to me, but could you rephrase that? You know, what has he given me again?
Yeah.
And his brother says, well, he's given you this family. He's given you this nice life. And it's like, all of a sudden, you know, maybe, I don't know how Larry takes that. We don't really know. But it's true that things could be worse, you know, and maybe.
Well, but except that, I mean, at least at that point in the story, all of those nice things that he has are completely falling apart.
Yeah.
You know, his wife is leaving him. His children have are not turning out well, I think it's safe to say. His job is in the process of possibly falling apart. And so in this sense, I think you can cut a different literary text that seems to be invoked is Job and the book of Job. Mm-hmm. And I know several critics have talked about that.
Yeah.
You know, that we've got, instead of the three friends who come to visit him, visit Job, it's Larry going to visit three different rabbis, but getting equally unsatisfying answers. And for me, the allusion to Job, one, I actually didn't think of it until a couple days after I'd seen the film. It's not obvious. At least to me, it wasn't obvious. And in part, it wasn't obvious to me because Larry's problems seem really mundane compared to Job's. When one of your main problems is that your neighbor is building a fence a little too close to the property line, I'm not sure that's a, you know, it's a Job-like problem. but it's... And so for me, my frustration with the film sort of gets at this sense of that meaninglessness, I guess, maybe is part of it. Although I wouldn't accuse the Coen brothers of going that far. I think actually their movie might be more interesting if they did. There's a sense of, what are you going to do kind of thing.
Well, I think the thing about I think you're right that the family line that he's giving you, this family, may be ironic.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it is mundane also.
Mm-hmm.
He's not losing his family, even if he has a couple of brats who are fighting all the time and don't seem to take things seriously that he takes seriously. He does have a nice family.
Really?
Well, he has he has two human beings, well, who he spawned. Well,
this gets at my problem with the Coen brothers' humor. At every step of the way, you know, there's nothing attractive about Esther in this movie. I mean, she's just a shrew in every sense of the word. The only thing that we really see with the daughter is just that, you know, she swears a lot. That's her character trait. The boy has more to him because he's getting ready for his bar mitzvah. But still, you know, it's like, I'm not sure that, I mean, and again, I won't give certain things away. The bar mitzvah scene is actually pretty funny. But, you know, it's not the sort of boy that instills pride, although maybe not. There are many 13-year-old boys that do.
He could hope for more, certainly. Yes. But I think you're right, though, that his problems are mundane. And the thing about the your neighbor building his fence too close, or his shed too close to your property line, has everything to do with Larry's sense of legalism and mm-hmm. rules. He mm-hmm. may not be a very devout Jew, but mm-hmm. he follows strict rules in his daily life. You know, he has a student who's trying to bribe him to raise his grade, right. and he comes back to him and says, you know, actions like that, actions have consequences. And the student says, often, yes.
Yes, often, yes.
No, always, he says, which it reminded me of that scene in Bottle Rocket when, you know, Owen Wilson's character is pulling this heist, and in the middle of the heist, in the middle of the robbery, the people he's robbing come back, and he says, what are you doing here? You're always at lunch at this time. And they say, not always. Yes, always. Mm. No, not always. The world doesn't work according to these strict rules as much as he would like it to. And I think part of the reason that he wants it to is because it bestows a certain seriousness on him. Mm-hmm. And it is a way of living his life that he knows that he's doing the right thing. And when those things turn out to be sort of absurd, his world falls apart.
Well, and I think it's more than that. It's I think Larry in his heart of heart knows that the world doesn't work like that. But he has to have some sense of order. He has to have some sense of control. In other words, okay, I can't control most everything. You know, it's I think it's important that early on in the film when we see Larry in class, he's talking about Schrodinger's cat. You know, this idea of, you know, this sort of famous physical puzzle or physics puzzle where, you know, you can't really know what's going on. And yet Larry wants to try to have control of at least his fenced in house, or, you know, a house with a property line. But I don't know it. I guess my frustrations exist that the Coen brothers take a lot of cheap shots at that kind of way of living. And I'm not sure that they're offering any kind of alternative. I mean, I think it's really easy to sort of take shots at people who are trying somehow to be serious people. And in the end, Coen brothers say, oh, yeah, I mean, well, like Larry says at one point, he goes, it proves we can't ever really know what's going on. You know, that sounds like the Coen brothers to me. And
the uncertainty principle.
Yeah. And yet it's I think that's a lot easier to say. When you have, you know, when you get to make the movie, you know, when you get to tell the story.
Well, I think Larry is the sort of person who believes in Heisenberg uncertainty principle when he's in front of a blackboard teaching it to students, and it's theoretical, but when it's in his own life.
Sure. Well, who would want to live like that?
Well, exactly. Well, but the Coens, I think, present two alternate examples, and one is the brother, the Mentaculus. Mm-hmm. It turns out this model. This is a very, very tiny spoiler.
Yes.
This model for the world, it actually is a way that he can make money gambling. Mm-hmm. And it works. It is a model for the world, and yet the authorities come and put handcuffs on him because that's not allowed. Mm-hmm. That's a shades of Kafka there. On the other side is the character who's probably least deserving of anything in this movie, his son, gets some grace bestowed on him at the end of the movie. For no reason whatsoever. Mm. You could see these things as examples of absurdity and irony, and that it doesn't really matter what you do, it's all random.
Yes.
Randomness also being
yes.
being something from No Country for Old Men. Or you could see it as, you know, embrace the mystery. There are some things that are ordered out there, but there is enough uncertainty that trying to follow too strictly any rules is bound to fail.
Yeah. I think there's something significant that the movie pretty much opens and closes with, you know, Jefferson Airplane screaming, you know, when the truth is found to be lies. You know, I think the Coen brothers are a little more fond of tearing things down.
But don't you want somebody to love?
Yeah. I'm not sure that Larry's going to find that. You know, that's, I think, again, if I felt like the Coen brothers actually had more sympathy for their characters, I would maybe be willing to embrace that sort of, you know, why don't you embrace the mystery? But I don't get that sense. You know, you talk about there's this moment of grace near the end, and I agree with that. And that is actually kind of a strangely nice moment. But I don't see a lot of grace for the characters in this film or in some of the other films of the Coen brothers I don't like. Burn After Reading is a nice example. You know, it's but other films in which, you know, it's just, you know, characters are just sort of set up to either be made fun of or to be belittled or to be wiped out at some points. I mean, we're not going to spoil the ending, but the ending is also somewhat significant, I think, in that way.
Yeah.
I like your allusion to the Kafka novel, though. I like the trial a lot too, and I can see that to some degree. It fits well with what they're doing as far as sort of this idea of uncertainty. I think I would really like this movie if it wasn't trying to be funny at times, if it actually was a serious film. But the humor rubs me wrong and makes me distrust everything that's going on, because it all feels just ironic in a really troubling way.
Well, the trial is it's heavily symbolic, and a lot of people have tried to figure out what it all means, which is a sort of a funny footnote to all of this. But some people have interpreted it as about Judaism, mm-hmm. and the law. So it's interesting that maybe the Coens have made that explicit. Mm-hmm. But I also like that the verbal humor that's in this movie, and maybe a lot of their movies, but this one, it pops up a lot, is it feels very Jewish, mm-hmm. and very, like, you know, like Yiddish jokes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it opens with a Yiddish joke.
Yeah.
You know, it opens with this, you know, sort of pastiche of every sort of bad Yiddish film that, you know, has ever been made. And it's actually quite funny, but yeah.
Yeah. It reminded me of a joke in a Chantal Ackerman movie.
Oh.
there are these two guys on the screen. One guy says to the other, "You know, life is like a fountain." And the other guy says, "Oh, really? How so?" And the first guy says, "All right, so it's not like a fountain."
What movie is that from?
It's from a movie. It's from a little movie called American Stories.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
It's a cool little movie she made about Polish immigrants in the U.S., Jewish immigrants in the U.S., and just about their experiences here. And it's a very amateurish movie, lovingly amateurish. Yeah. I mean, people are just sort of standing in a vacant lot giving these monologues, okay. or reading them in some cases, telling jokes. But it's just a really wonderful, rich movie of that sort of thing. Some of them are jokes like that are absurd, but also have this, like, gosh, what's funny about that? It's really hard to say. It gets at some sort of level of angst or irritation with people, or, you know, something. I think that's true of a lot of the dialogue that the Coens write.
Fortunately, The Serious Man has more than just that kind of joke. It's not that I dislike the film, but I do find it frustrating. And I do think that if you're going to sort of line it up with the trial or use that as the sort of the primary literary allusion, that befits the movie better. But I think if you're sort of lining it up with Job, then it looks really pale in comparison. And that for me is sort of where it comes down for me.
Well, speaking of Chantal Ackerman, mm-hmm. we saw one of her movies today called Dest, which is French for of the East, or from the East. Had you seen this before?
No, no, first time.
Yeah, same here. I don't even know. It's funny talking about this immediately after we see it, because it's kind of a hard movie to talk about, because it's a very rigorous. It was actually designed to be either a feature film or a museum installation, and it really feels that way. It's sort of an endurance test to sit there and watch it for a couple of hours, almost 2 hours. It's shots of people in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, Russia, or, well, Soviet Union at the time. Poland and what had been East Germany.
Yeah.
1993. It's so fairly soon after the, you know, fall of the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, I think 3 or 4 years after. It's mostly people just going about their daily lives. Mm-hmm. Lots of long tracking shots taken from a truck of people standing outside waiting for a bus. That's probably the primary image. But there are also shots of people inside preparing food or mm-hmm. putting on a record or, you know, pulling a buggy with horses, lots of things like that. But the primary image, I think, is tracking shot of people in a bus station or a train station or waiting for transit, often, usually, I would say, on a dark winter night.
Yeah. Yeah, and it becomes, it's interesting, the tracking shots don't start right away. I'd say the first 20, 30 minutes, maybe not that long, are mostly a series of static shots where the camera is stationary, and sometimes those are taking place indoors, sometimes out of doors. The static shots outside are often really interesting. I don't know if you had this experience, but it reminded me a little bit of James Binning's Railroad, mm-hmm. Just because of how cars sort of come into the frame from various angles, or people come into the frame from various angles. And I thought that was really interesting, and I like those static shots a lot. And it's also I've only seen a couple other Ackerman films. I've seen Jean Dielman, and then From the Other Side, but at least in the first, again, half hour of the film, it felt like the cuts are shorter. In other words, they're only maybe 20 to 30 seconds. It's not like we're talking a Michael Bay film or anything, but they're relatively short. And it's interesting to see how one shot sort of interacts with the one that follows. And I found that really interesting. But then, as you're right, particularly in the second half of the film, it becomes predominantly these tracking shots, and those are long, minutes sometimes, and you're thinking, wow, this is an enormous room, you know, and the outdoor shots are just along the streets and you know, mostly at night and mostly on snowy nights, but some of the tracking shots take place in what I assume are either bus terminals or train terminals. And boy, they're endless.
Yeah.
Just passing row after row of people waiting and waiting and waiting. So I actually really like tracking shots just as a device. I usually find them really interesting. But I didn't in this film, at least not as they went on. The first few, I said, oh, wow, that's really fascinating. But then they felt, I don't know if you had this experience, Rob, but they felt very repetitive after a time. Mac, there were a couple that I was like, wait, is this the same one that I saw earlier? I was sort of looking for people that I might recognize to see if it was. Whereas the static shots, I always found interesting. And I think I wrote in my notes that stationary shots of people while we move are not as interesting as people moving while we're stationary. But that was sort of my experience of the film.
After seeing a bunch of tracking shots like that, especially of people who are aware of the camera going by and who are sort of glancing awkwardly at the lens and or trying not to,
yeah.
You know, sometimes talking to it because there's sound with all of this too. I really desperately want somehow to see the reverse shot.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I did too.
After a while, it's like I want to see the people behind the camera. What are they doing? What do they look like?
Yeah, yeah. I want to move into a Kiarostami film almost.
Yeah.
And actually, I was sort of hoping that the movie might end with that moment. You know, that because I was, as you go on, you're thinking, well, I wonder how this will end. Because it seems like, you know, whatever her final shot will be might have some significance. I'm not actually sure it does, but I thought, wouldn't it be cool if the last shot was that reverse shot of us looking at the film crew? We never get that moment.
It does feel like sketches. It doesn't feel like a rigorous. It's a rigorous film in some ways, mm-hmm. in that it's a sort of harsh style,
mm-hmm.
but it's not rigorous in the sense that I feel it has a very strong structure that's saying something to me, or even that the shots are composed in a way that they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm supposed to compare, you know, across cuts or something like that.
Oh, see, I felt that way in the first half. There's that one sequence that's really, really wonderful. It's one of the first, because actually the first, again, half hour isn't in the wintertime. It's much more in summer or spring.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the very first wintertime sequences is of people walking outdoors. And it's actually, I think it's the same people. And it's just a really fun series of about four or five shots where they're coming in from different sides. And there's this one really beautiful moment where they're walking up the hill. And so they've started in the bottom right corner of the screen and they end up in the top left-hand corner of the screen. And so I found that really fun. I also noticed early on that oftentimes shots would like, they would be these interesting pairs. You'd go from outdoors to indoors, or you'd go from old person to young person, or you'd go from people walking towards you to people walking away from you. And so I found those, I don't know, they're not exactly rhymes, but juxtapositions, I guess, pretty interesting. And it was just fun. It was almost a little game to play. But then once we got to the tracking shots, and they're so long, it's hard to figure out what is coming before or after. In other words, how is this, you know, why is this one here and not somewhere else?
Yeah. I think that's part of why I think you're right that there were those patterns early on. I forgot about that because the latter half of the movie doesn't feel like, it feels like the patterns have fallen apart. Mm-hmm. And it may be because of how it was shot and how it was expected to be presented in a museum. Mm-hmm. It's possible that those shots you're talking about are they're almost triptychs. You know, yep. You could imagine the three shots being shown simultaneously, mm-hmm. almost of the three same people walking, because there were several sequences like that where it wasn't three separated shots, it was three connected shots. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's true.
Yeah. My favorite one in that moment of the people walking outdoors in the winter is the last one where they're walking to the horizon. And they're framed really beautifully by these trees along the side of the road. And
it's very Bel-Air.
It is. It's extremely Bel-Air. It was really fantastic. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, let this shot just go on for a long time. And it does. It's actually quite a long shot in comparison to the other ones. And they don't quite reach the horizon, but they get close. And I thought that was very satisfying. I had a question for you. I didn't know if you had the same experience. With the first two or three tracking shots, it felt very much like a counterpoint to the infamous tracking shot in Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend. If you remember that amazing tracking shot that happens in this traffic jam.
Unforgettable.
Yes, in the middle of nowhere. And it felt to me in a certain way, and maybe I thought of this because the professor who was introducing the film sort of mentions a counterpoint to Godard, a different film.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if you had the same experience of thinking of this as a somehow an answer to the Weekend tracking shot.
I can't believe I didn't think of that. That's great. I like that a lot. No, that's a cool way to think of it, because we're sort of talking about the movie as this formal piece of art, mm-hmm. when it's also a look at a world. You know, this is how people live.
Right.
These are real people, and I like that. I like, it's not anywhere that I've ever been. Mm-hmm. It's not a life I've ever lived, and so I love anything that can take me there and show me that for a long time and ask me to live. I mean, even as I was watching long tracking shots and thinking, oh, I wonder when this tracking shot's going to be over. I was thinking, this tracking shot is shorter than the length of time those people I'm looking at are going to be waiting for the bus. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And it is a counterpoint to Godard's Weekend, where it's the bourgeoisie wrecked with their wrecked sports cars on the highway.
And also, as I was struggling early on in the film, because I knew it's a film that's made in 1993, you know, From the East or Out of the East is being the title. And so I came into it with this preconception that it was going to be about, you know, East and West. And that it was going to be, in that sense, a political film, or at least a political history kind of film. And yet it's not. I mean, it almost seems aggressively not that. And I get the sense that maybe Ackerman is trying to argue in a way similar to what she might do in Jean Dielman, that traditional ways of looking at history are focus on great men and great events and things that change, you know, and here's the moment in which things change. And yet, as I'm watching this, I'm wondering, I wonder how different that is. I mean, that could have been maybe from the 70s. It might have been from the 50s. I mean, the footage is shot in 93, but how different are their lives? And I think that's a pretty powerful statement to make. And I think that's, I'm interpreting, so I don't actually know that Ackerman means to do this, but it feels like an answer to sort of political films a la Godard, you know, and sort of great man ideas of history or great event ideas of history, and saying, you know, people lead pretty normal lives, and they lead pretty normal lives no matter what happens. I don't know.
I think that's a fair way to see it, and I think especially, you know, from what we know about Chantal Ackerman from her other movies, I think that's definitely a valid way to see it, especially since it really is focused on a certain class of people, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, there are a few shots of, like, there's a a cello recital, mm-hmm. for example, and there are a few cases where we see people who have more money. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's just a standard working class of people for the large bulk of the movie,
yep.
which that in itself is a statement. You yep. could say it's anti-political, but it's a political statement
sure.
of its own.
Yeah. No, that's right. No, and I think, yes, and so, yeah, when I, yeah, anti-political wouldn't be the phrase I'd want to use.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
I'm not sure how the best way to phrase it, but it is a very political act to sort of imply that those traditional ideas of politics aren't really what's important. And so in that sense, I mean, Weekend, of course, is an unbelievably political film, and I love that movie. But it would make sense that Ackerman would say, no, that's not politics. This is real politics here. And I think it's also significant that with only two or three exceptions, almost all of the tracking shots go from right to left, as in other words, from east to west. There's a really wonderful moment. One of the exceptions near the end of the film that actually goes from west to east is showing this line of people, all of whom are holding items they've bought. You know, they're bottles of Pepsi or other things that I could
almost on display as if.
Yes. As if they were a model, you know, like, here they are on The Price is Right, showing you what you can win.
You know what? I kind of thought maybe they were selling those.
Oh, maybe so. It's it felt to me, though, that it was a sort of a sly commentary on what is the West given the East? Oh, they've given it crap. You know, they've given it more things that they can buy. I'm sort of assuming certain things, but it felt that way.
There was a shot of sort of a beach scene and people sitting at tables under umbrellas, and every single umbrella had the Pepsi logo.
Yeah.
On it, you know?
There's lots of Pepsi logos in the film.
Yeah. These are Pepsi countries. You know, yeah. You're talking about China having Coke having China. Mm. Well, let's take this as an excuse to talk about Chantal Ackerman.
Okay.
Would you like to say something about Jeanne Dielman? That's probably her most famous.
Yeah, movie. And it's a fantastic film. I'm sorry I haven't seen it in probably 6 or 7 years, and so certain things have faded from memory. But it's 3 hours and 20 minutes, and it focuses almost exclusively on this woman who. And the image that is most seared into my mind is that she sits at a table and she cuts. I was somewhat pleased to see a very similar moment in the movie tonight. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, women are still sitting at tables and cutting. But the movie is, it's often seen as sort of a feminist touchstone. It's revealing what it's like to be a housewife and the drudgery of that. I mean, the movie's length is very much part of its statement that it's trying to, I think, portray of what it's like to be this person. And so it's a really difficult but really profound and powerful work. It's certainly one of my favorite films.
And it's been a while since I've seen it, but I don't remember any camera movement at all. It's a very still movie. Mm-hmm. And it carves up the space in very interesting ways. Mm. You know, there are basically a couple of rooms that Jeanne Dielman spends most of her day in, and just moving to a new setting is like a brief breath of fresh air, mm-hmm. and then it's back to the kitchen, the table where she prepares the food.
Yeah.
And we see it from the same angles. Sometimes we'll see it from the side, but we can tell, oh, this is the same room, and we're gonna sit here for 15 minutes and mm-hmm. watch it from this angle now. Mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting use of space, and I see that sort of repeated in the newer films of Ho Chau Shin and mm-hmm. people like that who've adopted a rigorous style. She did this since 1970. Something,
five, I think.
75, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, that sort of master shot style, which when people sort of denigrate it, you know, they say, oh, well, all you have to do is set up your camera. It's like, no, that's not all you have to do. You know,
you have to resist the pressure of people telling you, move that camera.
Well, and just like you say, it carves up space. Yeah. I mean, it uses space in such fascinating ways. You know, where is that camera placed? How are we looking at something? And I found, again, the static shots in Out of the East tonight, I found those fascinating in the same way. It's like, wow, that's a really interesting place to shoot across. You know, you're mm-hmm. shooting across a room in a really fascinating way. Whereas in Jeanne Dielman, it's like a master class in that. It's,
yeah.
You know, scene after scene that you just, it's a punishing film in certain ways, and yet you can't take your eyes off of it. It's just riveting, despite the fact that, you know, not much is happening, at least not in contemporary, you know, by contemporary standards.
Yeah, and this has set the the sort of tone for, or maybe it's just the first example or one of the earliest examples of this obsession of hers with how a person's identity relates to the space they're in.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds sort of highfalutin, but she definitely tells us things about people by showing us the space where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And this recurs in so many of her movies. One of my favorites, it's actually on my top 18 of all time, is a movie called The Man with the Suitcase.
Okay.
And it's in some ways it's very similar to Jean Dielman, but it's about a writer. And it's about she goes to this house where she's going to write. She's borrowing the space, and she doesn't realize that the person has also loaned it to someone else, a man who shows up. And there's plenty of room for two people there, but something about this is an obvious invasion. And just the way the woman sort of recoils to a corner, unable to work until the space is freed up again, is really, it plays out. It's not as long as John Dielman. It's only like an hour, so it's like a fairly short movie. But it's as a writer who most writers are trying to fit writing into their normal lives. Mm-hmm. I think it definitely speaks to people as writers. Mm-hmm. It also has obvious feminist undertones or overtones. Mm. And it's also a little bit funny in a sort of dark way, in the way this woman can't really function when there's someone else there. I'm oversimplifying the whole thing, but it's yet another example of where space is so important.
Mm.
But you know, she has made a lot of funny movies too. One of her most recent ones is called Tomorrow We Move. And it's a total comedy. It's a farce, but it's about this woman who's moving and she needs to sell her place, her apartment. And so she has people coming in to look at it, and they all come in and they critique it, and it almost feels personal for people to say, no, this space isn't quite right. And so she begins, you know, she's selling it to people, and so she begins to sort of, you know, fall in love with it again because it's, you know, to have people come in and say, no, this doesn't have the right feeling. Or the whole movie is just all about space and how she moves through the space and how she's trying to find a new space, and she goes there, and you can tell when you walk in, this space isn't me.
And it's funny because that's a great point, Robin, and it makes me think of the movie Out of the East, that one of my problems with the tracking shots was that the space seemed really amorphous. I mean, obviously, most of it's outdoors, but there was a lack of definition to it and a lack of rigor, maybe, that it's like, I think we could be shooting this in a whole variety of different ways. And whereas in the best scenes of Ackerman's films that I've seen, you get the sense that the camera really could only be placed there. And it's really key that you look at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
So
I think that's true. I think the movie we saw tonight is atypical in that way. Although there's another way that she looks at space, which is the experience of immigrants.
Mm.
She's from Belgium. I believe her family is from Poland.
Okay.
And regardless, the experience of Polish Jews has been a topic of interest for her and of people just immigrating in general.
Yep.
And so there's the movie I mentioned, American Stories, about the people who are in the U.S. and telling their stories. And it's shot in a vacant lot, basically. It's shot with colored lights, and they have some props like cafe tables with these light bulbs hanging above them, swinging. Mm. It's, you know, sort of theatrical, and yet it's just an outside kind of thing. And it says something about these outsiders. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even have an indoor space. This is their makeshift world.
Mm.
Tomorrow We Move is actually that doesn't fit this example. But anyways, that does sort of fit Dest out of the East, in that we know so much about the way these people's lives have been politically, upheaved, and a lot of them have had to move and all of that. So.
No, absolutely, and it's fascinating to me in Out of the East. Again, there are exceptions to this. It's not like it's all one way or all another way, but most of the people who don't move in this film are older. Most of the people who are stationary are older, and it just got me thinking, what an amazing time it would have been to live in the late 80s in Eastern Europe, and yet really difficult if you were, say, in your 60s or your 70s.
Yeah.
Because you had grown used to one way of life, and whether you liked that way or not, it was your life. And then suddenly there's huge upheaval, and everyone's going, well, it's, you know, let's do something about this. I remember a couple of years ago, there was a great Romanian, maybe a year and a half ago, a year ago spring, Romanian retrospective here in Chicago, and a couple of the films were really profound about how difficult it was for an older generation when the younger generation just wanted to move, and they wanted to head west. And I was sort of thinking about that tonight in this film, that you know, that, yeah, there might be more freedom, and most people in the East might think that post 89 is great, but I'm sure that not everyone does, and not even everyone would have thought so at the time.
Did you get the sense in those early pastoral shots, the static ones in this movie, that oftentimes they were interrupted by a car going by?
Yes.
After a while, I was thinking, maybe we should be on that car if that's where people are, if that's how people are living. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out we end up on the truck.
That's right. We do. Yeah, that's right. It's but to go back to your point about space, which I like a lot, I was just thinking that some of my favorite shots in this film are outdoors, but how she uses space outdoors. There's that, well, I think probably my favorite moment in the film is it's a night shot, and there's lots of people walking out on the street, and they're all in silhouette, but off screen, and you know it's off screen because you can sort of sense where it is, a rock band starts playing. And it's this really beautiful shot. I mean, just these silhouettes are really gorgeous. But that sense of what I can see and yet what I know is happening somewhere over there. And then we suddenly cut to over there. Not that we see the band, but we see people dancing to the band. And it's that's my favorite moment in the film, that sort of juxtaposition, those two shots, I think are really, really great. So,
yeah, and it's always fun to pick out people in the crowd. In these long static shots where you're watching for a long time, it's fun to pick out people and just sort of watch the funny things they do. You know, why is that guy trying to hand the person who's playing an instrument a note? Wait till they're done. You know, they're busy.
Yeah.
She has another movie called Night and Day that I like also. It's about a woman who has two boyfriends, one in the night and one in the day.
Oh.
And two different, it's a way of sharing the apartment.
Okay.
And but of course this requires a sort of suspension of time, mm-hmm. as well, because someone can't really function without any sleep.
Right.
And so I like that as an idea. I remember enjoying the movie. I've only seen it once, and I'd have to see it again to know more what I think of it. But I remember liking that as an idea, because time is also this element that she uses. These mm-hmm. sound like just fundamental things that mm-hmm. she's playing with: space, time. But she does them in such interesting ways, and that happened in Death Tonight again, just like mm-hmm. in John Dielman, where the length of the movie mm-hmm. or the length of a shot is testing something mm-hmm. about you, or it's expressing something, or mm-hmm. it's an integral part of this movie. It wouldn't be the same if it were in a bunch of little shots.
No, it's true. But I'm curious if you had the same experience I did, which is as the tracking shots became more frequent, you know, because at first there's like two or three of them, and then you go back to static shots. But then it becomes fairly insistent, tracking shot after tracking shot after tracking shot, that I couldn't figure out why there was the length. In other words, I know that it's supposed to be long.
Yeah.
I mean, and I understand that. But why so long? In other words, it didn't feel like there was a sense of, it needs to be this long and no longer. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure why it ended at some points and others didn't end at that point. I wasn't sure if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it does feel a little formless in some ways. And I sort of attributed that to the fact that it was intended to be assembled loosely. They sort of described to us how it was installed in museums in some places. It was in three separate rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So the shots were not strung together. They were in pieces.
Yep.
And they were sort of playing simultaneously, but you'd move from one room to the other to see them in a sequence. So it's a little funny, mm-hmm. and it's possible that has something to do with
sure.
why it plays out the way it does. Also, just my personal preference for very long movies is I really like to have the lay of the land.
Mm.
I like to know, and I also understand that sometimes filmmakers want to deny me mm-hmm. this, and that's okay too. But I really crave, how far are we? How far do we have to go? Mm-hmm. I really love to see people accomplish a task.
Mm.
We've talked about Michael Haneke before. There's the scene in Funny Games where.
Mm.
Naomi Watts in the newer version has to get up off the ground
mm-hmm.
even though she's bound and
right.
gagged and move into another room.
Yep.
That doesn't feel long to me because it's a task that mm-hmm. needs to be accomplished, and I can watch it. You know, mm-hmm. I know what it's going to take to get there, even if I don't know
yeah.
exactly how it's going to play out. And sometimes when I'm watching these these people who really test the limits of film, like Béliard,
mm-hmm.
7 hour Satan
right.
Tango, I just like to know where I am. I like mm-hmm. chapters. I like mm-hmm. to have a sense. And I didn't feel very much of that from this movie at all, partly because it's so formless. It just sort of goes for a while and then it's over,
mm-hmm.
like an installation that is intended to loop.
And it's for me, I was thinking about that too, that the way I view movies is very different than the way I view installations and museums. just because in a museum, I'm so used to, I control how long I stay in front of each artwork. And therefore, I don't have the patience in a museum that I have in a theater. In the theater, I assume that I've given up control of that. I'm there until, you know, the credits come up. And so when I see a movie in an art museum or an installation, I rarely watch the whole thing. Even if it's 20 minutes, I rarely watch it. I sort of watch it for 4 or 5 minutes until I get kind of bored or until I go, okay, I've seen it. Whereas I would never do that in a movie theater. I would stay till the end, no matter how difficult it was.
Yeah, I hate installations.
Yeah.
The seats are never good. People are walking in front of you. They're up and down, and the lights are bad. And
yeah.
I don't know. Have you ever seen one that you liked?
There was. The only one I've ever seen was at the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Chicago, probably 12, 14 years ago. I think her name is Pipilotti Wrist. And it was a video. It wasn't very long, which helped. Maybe 10, 11 minutes. And it was a video of her. Well, I'm not sure it was her, but someone swimming. And I know this was her. She sings Chris Isaak's Wicked Game, but she sings it kind of badly. And yet it's quite hypnotic the way she sings it. For some reason, I love that video, and I don't know why. I just did. I saw it several times, but that's the only one. That's the only installation I can say. I've seen, like, there's been times where there's like Chris Marker installations. You know, and it's like, wow, Chris Marker.
Yeah.
And 5 minutes later, I'm up and moving.
I saw the Chris Marker installation at MoMA a few years ago, and I stayed, you know, to see the whole film, mm-hmm. and I thought about it and wrote about it, and I liked the film, but I really didn't like the experience mm-hmm. of watching it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, for me, I'm sort of grateful that we saw the Chantal Ackerman in a theatrical environment, you know, in a sort of continuous hour and 50 minute sequence, even if that, I don't know if that's really the way it was designed to be seen.
I saw another of her installations that way. That just comes to mind. I kind of forgot about this. I don't even remember what it was called. But it was, at first, it just seems like there's, it's a black screen, but in the middle of it, like an inset, there's a little picture moving. Can't even really tell what it is. It's a little blurry. And then it repeats every 10 minutes or so. And eventually, there seems to be like a rectangle around it. Mm. And then eventually, you realize the sun is coming up at a drive-in. And she's projecting the picture on a drive-in. And we're standing way back with the camera looking at the drive-in screen. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, I sat there for an hour and watched it. I watched it repeat because I was trying to figure out.
Is this an Ackerman film?
It was, yeah. Okay. And I don't remember what it was called. But I watched it because I was intrigued about, first of all, what am I looking at? Mm-hmm. Also, what is going on in this loop? Mm. And I stayed for the whole thing. It was like an hour, and it was intended to I think, just loop from there, too. But it's the sort of thing I wouldn't have discovered in a theater. Mm. I would have seen it in a few minutes and not seen the sunrise, for mm-hmm. example. I would have seen just whatever state it happened to be in at the time.
Is For me, I'm curious, did you come in then at the beginning, quote unquote, the beginning?
This was at a retrospective, so it was in a theater, sort of like Tonight, where they just played it. Yeah,
okay.
I didn't
see it in a...
No, I did not.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Because that, for me, is always one of the frustrating things when I go into an art installation is, where have I come in? You know, I don't know if I've come in early in... I mean, you almost never come in right at the beginning. So how close are we to the beginning? Are we in the middle? Are we near the end? And... I don't know. There's something very orderly about my brain. I hate to be late to movies for the same reason. If I miss the beginning, how can I possibly process the middle and the end? I mean, that's just, it's...
But that used to be how people watched movies,
yeah.
You know, until Psycho,
yeah.
When Alfred Hitchcock demanded that you had to wait.
Yeah.
The lore is that he worried that people would wonder where Janet Leigh is because he kills her off in the first third. Where is the star of this film if you come in the middle?
Well, I was just thinking about this today because I won't name the critic, but there's a critic in Chicago who's somewhat infamous for missing the first 10 minutes of a film. He just never is there when it starts. And sometimes he'll convince the projectionist to actually show the first 5 to 10 minutes at the end. And it's like, that's a really weird way to watch a film. It's you know, you saw the whole thing, but you didn't quite see it in the right order. But I don't know. Anyway.
Well, J. Robert, it's been great talking to you again.
Absolutely.
Hope we'll get back to doing this more often.
Yeah, it was. It was great fun. And two fun movies that, I don't know, have there's some overlap there.